Most of you know who I am. I know most of you by sight. I don't know all of your names. This is Ann, and that's Tim. That's Liz, and that's Paul.
Rich.
Rich.
Chuck.
Chuck. I'm Charles. What I want to talk about soon, share some things with you and get some feedback and response from you, is Images for Exile. That title specifically has to do with a number of projects, past and future, that I've been involved with through my theater company, Theater Unlimited. Theater Unlimited, by its, on the basis of its philosophy and its existence, works out of the belief that theater, all arts, but theater particularly for us, are available and accessible to everyone. Theater perhaps being more accessible to more people, simply by the very nature of the fact that its elements are part of everyday life. To learn how to, as we were talking about last night in the Courage to Create session, to learn how to interact with people is what we do with our lives. It's different than learning the notes on a keyboard, or the fingerings on a violin, or the depth perception required on a canvas, or the ability to take something out of stone and make it into something that other people can recognize. Theater involves the things of everyday life, relationships, words, actions, interactions, people being together with people. And on the basis of this philosophy, and the philosophy that theater and all other arts are communal at their base, that they began in history with people attempting to communicate with each other. People, for example, I always think, I guess particularly in terms of Native Americans, partially because in Minnesota I work a lot with them, partially because when I see the country around us here and realize that probably Native Americans walked through here long before there was a Holden village or anything else. People who are that, quote, primitive, unquote, are also people who communicate on lots of different artistic levels at the very beginnings of culture. The image that I always come up with is around the fire at night, the community has shared a meal which hunters perhaps have brought in. And probably the very next step, or often the very next step, was for the hunters to then rise out of the group and show the group what happened. One hunter became the animal, and the other hunters hunted it down and showed who was brave, who was strong, who did what. The community then participated in the bringing of that food, as well as in the eating of it, and they grew together as a community. There wasn't a separate group that nobody knew what they did or how they did it. They were explaining what they did. They did that through action, through song, words, through poetry. At the basis of all culture, I think, is art. That's what I tried to point out in Rollo May's book last night. That belief leads me to the philosophy also that it is unlimited, that anyone can be involved in the act of creating. And what I have found with the groups that I've worked with over the past 15 years is that I have yet to work with a group to whom I have come with a workshop with the intention of creating something who has not said to me when I began, oh, we could never be creative like that. And at the end, they have always created something as a group. As individuals, again, we may feel uncreative, but perhaps in a group setting, we begin to feel that we can expand ourselves. We may do a little bit of an exercise later on which will help point that out maybe more clearly. But to the point of Images for Exile, while I was in Miami last year, I began working with the Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Miami and the Wesley Foundation, the Methodist Campus Ministry. We looked at the culture of Miami, and those of you who may be familiar with what South Florida is like right now will understand that when you talk about exile, there are very few places in this country where you can go where there are more people in exile than in South Florida, particularly County and the city of Miami or Miami Beach. And as we looked at people being in exile in that place, we realized that there were many different reasons why they were in exile. You could not pin it down to one cause for that exile. Some of them chose to be there, having retired, moved from New York, the East Coast, the Midwest, chose to go to a place where they could get out of the snow, get out of the cold, live a little more comfortably, not have to worry about all the hassles. They chose their exile. They did it because they had money. There are other groups of people who have gone there from other places in this country to serve those people who have chosen to live there, who go there for vacations, who go there to retire. There's a whole class of people in Miami that work as servants, literally. Waiters, waitresses, caddies at golf clubs. People who have gone to work in industry, or not industry so much as merchants, stores, selling things to the people who have chosen to be there. And you get other classes of people, the Cubans who first came when Castro took over Cuba, who ran for their lives, ran to South Florida, and now live in little enclaves, still waiting to go back to Cuba, waiting to fight. People who fought in the Bay of Pigs invasion. People who still hope that someday they will go back. And you get more people coming in recently, 250,000 refugees, thrown into the economy and the life of South Florida for all kinds of other reasons. Kicked out of Cuba, put on boats, and set out in the South Atlantic, running from the oppression of Haiti, getting on anything that will float and going out into the South Atlantic. All converging on one place in a very short period of time into a culture that is trying desperately to adapt itself and integrate them when many of those people still don't have a bed to sleep on. Many of them still sleep under bridges. In that culture, we began to see that, for one thing, the true minority of Miami are the people who were born there. I mean, just a very odd fact about that place. If you meet somebody who says, oh, I was born in Miami, that's a rare thing in your experience. We began to realize that perhaps that minority had something to tell the rest of us about how you live in a climate like that. Not an easy place to live. We also began to see that all of these different groups being in exile must have some common image in some place. If exile is common to all of them, then there must be other things that are common to all of them. I worked a little bit with a language program at the University of Miami for students from Chile who had come to study computer science mostly, and part of their education had to be to learn English, learn it every day. They had to go for 2 hours and study English every day. And talking with them and finding out how they approached the city, coming from Chile and basically not changing anything about how they live. They simply moved into dormitories together, stayed together, studied together, worked together, lived together. What kind of images did they come up with about the new place that really wasn't the new place? And as we looked at those images, we decided that we would maybe work on a program that would help us gather images, get people creating and externalizing these images, and find some ways that we could relate to each other based on what it means to be in exile. What does it mean to any of you to be in exile? I want just images, words. When you hear that term, when you think about being in exile, what does it say to you?
Anger.
Could you just expand on what about or what toward or?
Well, obviously you're there for a reason, and chances are it has something to do with somebody creating your situation for you in one way or another.
All right, so an external force has something to do with why you're there, and one response to that is often anger. Anybody else?
Ruthlessness.
Ruthlessness. Anybody else?
Loneliness.
What else?
Anxiety. Away from home. Okay.
Away from home. Oh, home can be lots of things, but it's away from.
What else?
I would think impatient.
Impatient for the return, impatient for the situation that you're in.
Fear that you might have to go back. Especially for some of the refugees.
Okay. Fear of return.
or the opposite fear of not being in the theater.
Okay. And fear of remaining. Deuteronomy 30, 2 Chronicles, Ezra 6, the whole book of Esther, Isaiah 5, Isaiah 45, Jeremiah 13, Jeremiah 24, Jeremiah 29, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Amos, Hebrews, Psalms, where the word exile appears, just the word, not even things about being in exile, just the fact that that word exists in those places. And the history of the people of Israel, as any of us who remember what those stories are about. Abraham, the father of the people, was uprooted and taken someplace else. And then his family was uprooted and taken someplace else, and they were uprooted and taken someplace else. Constant being in exile. Therefore, images that we can find in the Old Testament, many of them will speak directly to what it means to be in exile. Psalm 137 is often called the Ballad of the Exiles. Listen to the imagery of someone in exile. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, when they said, raise it down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, you devastate. Happy shall he be who requites you with what you have done to us. Happy shall he be takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks. Hatred and pain and anger and loss and longing. Powerful images, negative images, that come up from people living in the midst of exile. And yet, go back to Deuteronomy 30. Take other images, and it says, when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and you return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you this day with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion upon you. He will gather you again from all the people where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of the heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will fetch you. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, that you may possess it. And he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. Just the opposite. Think about when you are in exile. Think about the Lord, and you will be brought back. Fortunes will be restored. So being in exile has a flow to it. It's an up and a down flow. And that the feelings that we can get from being in exile can be so confused that we may not know how we feel from one moment to the next. project that happened in Miami as part of Images for Exiles there created a number of plays, brief plays, some of them that never got printed, two in particular that did get printed up. And I would like to just do a brief reading, if you would, of this play. I mean, four people, one of them needs to be a woman, so if you would take one of those, and somebody else back there would take one of those. The first play in this little collection, here's a copy to look at. The first play in this little collection is called State of Siege. It was an attempt by the group that got together to take images that we came up with, images which had something to do with authority, something to do with facing up to responsibility with each other in community. And we tried to image some kind of a drama that would speak about how we felt at that time. It turned out to be a rather eloquent little play about ending war. But we did not begin with any idea of writing an anti-war play. We started out with the idea of imaging what it's like to be in exile and how people might be able to touch each other when they are in exile. We have a narrator. I will read that part. There is a king.
Paul, is that right?
If you would read king. Tim, if you would be the soldier. Okay, and I'm sorry, I forgot.
Rich,
if you would read the priest. Liz, would you read the pilgrim? Those are the four characters in this play. Now, simply to imagine for the area of where the play happens, we have a castle here, large, old castle facing us. In front of the castle is a green leading into a meadow. The meadow is covered with soldiers. This is a medieval image, soldiers with spears, swords, armor, horses, waiting for the command of the king. It begins a distant kingdom, one you may never have heard of, once felt threatened by enemies. So the king gathered his finest knights. They stood before him in a large meadow, their weapons at the ready, their armor shining in the morning sun. The king enters, moves to center stage. The soldier enters. From the audience, stands to one side of center stage, bows his head to the king. The king speaks.
My chosen ones, the bravest, the strongest, the best our nation has to offer, you will go into battle for me, for all of us. You will destroy the enemy or be destroyed by them, but we will win. Their ways are not our ways. They cannot be trusted or ignored. They must be defeated. God will go with you, and you will not fail.
Priest enters, goes to the king. The king speaks.
You must bless these knights before they go into battle.
But your majesty.
It is your duty to give them hope and courage. They must fight bravely. They must win.
But I can't.
Bless them.
Pause. The priest moves reluctantly to the soldier. The soldier goes to one knee before the priest. The priest puts his hand on the soldier's head and pauses.
You must be brave, my child. God is with you. You must be with God.
Pause, leans close to the soldier's ear.
And you must not go.
Stands up straight. The soldier looks up at the priest, very puzzled. The priest moves back to the king. The battle trumpet sounds in the distance. The soldier rises automatically. The king moves to the soldier.
There is the signal. The battle will begin soon. Go and fight bravely.
The king exits. The soldier bows until the king exits, then looks up at the priest. The priest speaks quickly.
You must not go.
The battle trumpet sounds once again. The soldier exits toward the sound of the trumpet. The priest stands alone. The narrator enters. At the same time, a group of pilgrims were camped in the same meadow. They had traveled together for years from one holy place to another. One of their leaders went to watch the military show, then waited until the priest was alone. The pilgrim enters with the audience, approaches the priest, bows for
him. May I speak with you?
What is it, my child?
My friends and I have traveled together over time and distance, seeking holy places. Everywhere we stop, we ask to be blessed by the local priest. If you will be so kind as to say a few words for us now, we will continue our search.
Receive my blessing. Take my blessing for strength. You, all of you, go with God, and you must follow wherever God leads, however hard the way.
Battle trumpet sounds in the distance.
Do you hear that? That sound will lead you where you must go. Two great armies are about to join in battle, for no purpose but greed and evil. They must be stopped, and you can stop them.
We are simple pilgrims.
You are God's own children. You are peacemakers, and you can make them forget their madness.
How?
Lead your group into that narrow strip of land, which still separates the two armies. Stand silently between them and pray. Show them that war is not necessary. Show them the way of peace, and they will follow. Go with God.
We must. There is no other way to go.
Pilgrim exits. The priest watches the pilgrim, then the battle trumpet sounds again. The priest looks off stage and then hastens slowly. And so, the peacemakers marched, humble but determined, into the space between the two armies. They bowed their heads and showed the way of peace. The battle trumpet sounds. Then the battle began. At first, soldiers on both sides were confused and did not know what to do, but their commanders were insistent. The battle trumpet sounds again, and they could only respond. Distant sounds of the battle. The slaughter was enormous. The battle went on and on through the morning and into the afternoon. The sun was high and hot, and the few still alive had to stop if they were to stay alive. And there was a lull. Soldier enters from downstage, beaten, battered, staggering, moves to the center. Great agony, pulling off armor, drops his weapon, and collapses. After a moment, the pilgrim enters from the audience. The soldier tries to grab his weapon.
Who's there?
Relax. I won't hurt you. I'm one of the pilgrims.
Pilgrims? Fools. Praying in the middle of a battle?
Tries to laugh, but coughs, chokes. The pilgrim moves to the soldier, pulls a canteen of water.
Here, have some water.
Sits down next to him, holds his head, gives him water. When he finishes, she drinks. The soldier tries to sit up. His arm is wounded. He can't lean on it. He cries out in pain.
You're hurt. Here, relax.
She begins to wash his wounds. He leans back on her.
Are any of your pilgrims still alive?
Some. Not many. What about your soldiers?
A few. Why did you do it?
Because we had to.
Had to stand and pray in the middle of battle? Had to stand and be slaughtered? You're crazy.
Why did you do it?
Do what?
Fight.
Why do I fight? What a question. You are crazy.
Why?
Because I'm a soldier. That's what I do. I have to fight.
And end up like this? Beaten, wounded, your slaughtered friends around you?
We had to.
So, we are the same.
The same?
And both a little crazy.
The battle trumpet sounds again.
Again?
We will go on until we win.
No one ever wins.
But we will go on. Go home and pray for peace.
At home there is peace. Here is where we must pray. Don't go.
I have to go.
Battle trumpet sounds. The soldier exits. Pilgrim pauses and recites her canon.
So do I.
Exits follow the soldier. The battle trumpet sounds. The battle begins again. The battle raged and raged. Still rages. A very brief drama, created by people who do not consider themselves actors, writers, performers of any kind. People who simply found images. In the city of Miami, battle is not a distant image. Battle is something that people feel happens on the streets all the time. If you ever read the statistics of the murder rate in Miami, you realize that not quite so far from the truth. Battle is happening at all times, whether it's killing each other, or hating each other, or robbing from each other so that they can eat. People are fighting. And the image that we simply tried to portray here, the thought, the concept, was that if fighting is one means of being in exile, maybe another means of being in exile is touching, listening, asking, why are you doing this? What is it that makes you so hateful? If it is being in exile, I too am in exile from something. Maybe we can compare. It's not an attempt to solve problems necessarily. It's an attempt to find a resolution to tension. And it's the working at the resolving, and not the resolving itself, that can create art. Working together, coming up with images, making words, putting things out for others to see. That play and another play came out of that series of sessions and workshops. The other play, we won't go through it, but it's called By the Numbers. It's also in that little collection, and it takes place in an elevator. And there are a few images for living together with people in community that are better to find all of the little quirks and problems of dealing with each other than in an elevator, especially an elevator that gets stuck. And that's what this one does. There's another drama about an elevator was created here at Holden Village 2 years ago while I was on staff. Dealing with community, about being in an elevator, and there are copies of it both in the bookstore and here in the theater arts office if anyone's interested in taking a look at that. Another means of finding an image that we could relate to in terms of looking at the rest of society and what they have to say to us and what we have to say to them. Images for Exiles is also a title of a project that will begin in September in Minneapolis, funded by the American Lutheran Church Development Assistance Program, working with three specific groups in Minneapolis who, when you look at them, you begin to see that exile is a large part of their existence. These three groups are Hmong refugees from Laos, Native Americans who live in large numbers in South Minneapolis, and senior citizens and handicapped people. The purpose of this project is not necessarily to bring these three groups together, although it may happen because they are involved in a similar project, but to go to these three groups and find out what their images are, to listen, find ways in which we can relate to them and to someone and to other people what it is about them that is unique, what it is that they have to say with their images. I've already done about 8 weeks worth of work with Hmong refugees, and I'm working with an English as a Second Language program, which is teaching English basic level, how to buy food, how to make change, how to tell time, how to communicate to people, what bus you want to get on, basics of how you live in a city when you have come, as the Hmong have, from an agricultural background in Southeast Asia with almost no written language. Who were used by the CIA extensively during the Vietnam years to help organize rural people in Laos against the communist insurgents. And when our presence was removed from Southeast Asia, the CIA felt some responsibility to these people and were able to bring many of them over to this country. However, to move from the climate of Southeast Asia to the climate of South Minneapolis is a difficult move. These people have spent several serious winters trying to keep from starving to death and freezing to death. And they've made it, and with the help of our Savior's Lutheran Church there, a language project is going, which is helping to teach them English that they need to communicate. And as part of that project, I began doing a storytelling as a means to help people in desperate circumstances see what it is that they have to offer, see where their power is, see where their history is, see that stories are what keep us together. I firmly believe what Rollo May says in his book, that art and creativity are the basis of culture, not the frosting. And what I have found from these people is that not only does telling stories help them learn English, it helps me learn about Hmong people, and it helps them stay together. I've done a number of different types of teaching with them. I do pantomime sometimes, and as I do things, we put English words to them so that they see something, they know it, then they put an English word to it. It helps them a little bit to pick up on concepts, ideas. The other thing that we have done with them is collect their stories. After I tell them a story, they tell me a story. And we've collected a half a dozen of these stories, which have been handed on Much as the stories of the Old Testament were handed on from generation to generation verbally, everyone knows them, they are part of their culture. Our attempt is to help them hold on to those stories and to hold on to their culture so that they realize that they are still together, even though they're in a different place at a different time. They're together and they're working together to make it through what it is that they have to go through. I want to share a couple of these stories with you just in terms, again, of seeing images that come together. In Jeremiah 24, it says, "The Lord showed me this vision. Behold, two baskets of figs placed before the temple of the Lord. One basket had very good figs, like first ripe figs. The other basket had very bad figs, so bad that they could not be eaten. The Lord said to me, 'What do you see, Jeremiah?' I said, 'Figs. The good figs, very good. The bad figs, very bad. So bad they cannot be eaten.'" There's a story among the Hmong people which is called "Why There Are Rich Nations and Poor Nations." Long ago, when all things began, all people were the same, poor and hungry. They wandered through many empty lands and found very little food. As they came to the edge of the empty lands, they saw a beautiful green garden with a stone fence around it, so high they couldn't get over it. In the garden, they could see a giant tree full of beautiful ripe fruit hanging to the ground. When the people approached the gate, the caretaker opened it wide and said, "Come in, all of you, and eat of the fruit." People, crazy with hunger, all rushed forward to get to the food. Some pushed harder than others, so they would be first. When they got to the tree, they picked up the fruit that had already fallen on the ground and began to eat it as fast as they could. Much of the fruit they ate was bad and rotten, but in their hunger, they did not notice. The people who came next found no fruit on the ground and began to pull it off the low-hanging branches, stripped them bare. Those who came last found no fruit on the ground or on the lower branches. The only fruit left was high out of reach in the branches above them. But as they reached for that higher-up fruit, it fell off into their hands at the point of perfect ripeness, and they ate their fill. And so it is, the descendants of those who ate the poor fruit off the ground were poor for generation after generation. The descendants of those who ate the perfect fruit, and as they told me this story, they said, "You, in the United States, were rich for generation after generation." That also reminds me greatly of the Garden of Eden story, in reverse. Rather than being thrown out for eating the fruit, you are invited in. Eat the fruit. Another story that they tell that comes from the Hmong refugees, this also has a reference in, possible reference in Jeremiah, has to do with being in exile. This is from a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon. It says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where you have been, where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare." This story is called "When All the Animals Were Refugees." An explanation. In Laos, there is a certain type of monkey. It has a very distinctive call. Early in the morning, the males climb high into the trees and scream loudly into the distance, while the females sit at the bases of the trees and seem to hum. This legend explains the origins of that behavior. When the world began, it was dry desert almost everywhere. All the animals had to search from one place to another to find enough food and water. One band of monkeys lived in this dry wasteland, and every day the males would go out as far as they could to find food and water. Often, they returned at night with nothing. One day, all the males went to search for food, leaving the females and children behind. They traveled farther than they had ever been before, and soon it was too late and too far to return home. They rested that night, and the next day they decided to go even farther into the wilderness and hope for better luck. That night, they were too far away to even think about returning home. After many days of searching, the need for food and water was stronger than the need to return home. They searched and searched until finally they found an oasis. They were happy because life was very good at the oasis, but they could not remember how to get back to their families. Finally, they had to join with the other monkeys there. They started new families. Still, every morning, they climb the highest trees, scream into the distance, hoping their original families will hear them and come join them. At the same time, their new wives sit at the base of the trees, hum and purr, thinking, they will never hear you. They will never come again. But we are glad you will stay here with us. You'll notice, I think, and it goes through all the other stories, these people have lived in exile for many generations. These stories are very, very old, and their images all are of being in exile, being refugees, being hungry, being poor. It always amazes me that one story about the garden, when the world began, all people were the same, poor. That's how they see the world. That's how they imagine it all started. Why else would they be like this if it somehow didn't start like that? Other people were just lucky. These images, as I said, have been collected over a very short period of time. They are now printed and they are being put back into the language project as study tools. So these people are now learning their new language with their old stories. It keeps them together, it keeps them unified, it keeps them in community, it helps them move forward into a new place, a new time, a new community. Over 60 weeks, starting in September, twice a week, working, same kind of process, storytelling, creative dramatics, working as community, I'm hoping that new stories will begin to emerge. Old stories will be gathered even more, but new stories will begin to emerge. Already, we are able to take, with a group of 6 or 7 or 10 people, each one, maybe knowing only 5 words of English, and I can coax out of them one word, just a word that we know in English. Tell me a word. And I'll say, do you know a word of English? And they'll say, no. And I'll say, good, good. And we'll start with no. And slowly the words will come, just one. And those 10 words will go on the board. And from those 10 words, a story will emerge. And I can pantomime the story, and I can make them characters in the story without any lines, without any scenes or settings, simply the words. They know that much. With that much, we can tell the story. Simple, maybe, but a story. And what I'm finding is that nobody loves anything quite so much as a story. Everybody loves it. Everybody. The Native American community in South Minneapolis may be difficult in some ways, at least in terms of space to see how they are in exile. They have been there much longer than we have. It's their land, and they have always lived there, and yet their exile is severe and difficult and desperate. And in working with these people, I'm hoping to find within their community the people who have the images, the artists. Artists have always been powerful people among the Native Americans, many of the greatest chiefs and poets. That was why they were chiefs. Finding these images among the Native American community in their legends can help hold the community together, can help them begin to see hope, can help them begin to see maybe new ways or their old ways of dealing with the world. And sometimes we have to realize that the way we treat the earth, we have a great deal to learn from Native Americans. We seem to be getting into a lot of trouble and they seem to do pretty well with the way they treated here. So that aspect of the project will simply be pulling again the images that they have, creating new images, allowing the artists of the community to emerge, and allowing the community to see them, to visualize, to picture, to have those images out where everyone can see them, to give them a direction, to point them towards something. The senior citizens and the handicapped live in large numbers in South Minneapolis, and as you'll find in any city, there are areas where disenfranchised gather. The elderly, black, poor, the Hmong, the Native Americans, the Hispanics, whatever city it is, you can find them all in certain places. And it's very odd that we consider these people to be on the edges of society, and yet they are in the middle of the city, usually. Very interesting realization that they are in the center of everything, and we must deal with them all the time, and yet it's our desire to push them out to the side and forget about them. But the senior citizens that I'm working with, I've only done a couple of sessions with them, and yet once again, finding that stories are helping them to realize lots of different things. As part of one entertainment program that I did for senior citizens at a high rise, we did some storytelling. Just told some James Thurber stories, had some songs, had some pantomime, had some readings, and I read a couple of stories from the mom. And these people suddenly realized that this was their neighbors. People all around them, and they'd seen them, but they didn't know who they were. They had no knowledge of these people. Suddenly, with just a little bit of information and two stories, they were interested. Now they want to have an educational program, which will include bringing someone who knows a great deal about the Hmong and teaching them. Who are these people? They have stories. They must have history. They must be some. They live here. We have to deal with them. These are people who are in their 60s, their 70s, their 80s, their 90s. A lot of time, many things yet to learn, and they're ready to learn them. We also spent an evening telling stories to each other, 40 people sitting around. It's a unique building in many ways. It's owned by Ebenezer Society, which, if you're familiar with that, is a Lutheran-based sort of a management company. They own and run and manage a number of different buildings throughout Minneapolis and I think the whole state of Minnesota. This building in particular has many Lutherans in it, and yet it is a public housing project, and so there are many people, they cannot restrict it to Lutherans. There are many people who are hearing impaired, there are many people with other disabilities, and so the community is split up amongst different groups. It is also split up, and again, the image is for exile. It is split up because people have been forced to come there and live in a place that is one apartment. Two rooms, maybe. And they have come from their homes where perhaps they've lived for 40 years, 50 years. Try to bring into this one-bedroom apartment something that is theirs and will allow them to live as they have always lived. Their lives have changed radically. And they are very caught up in how their lives have changed, and they have little time sometimes for each other. And yet what we found in storytelling was that they have lots of time for each other because their images are the same. It may have been a different place where they came from, but their families gave them the same feelings. Their history, their background allows them to deal with each other. We started out very slowly with telling stories, and yet after a while someone said, well, I wish the deaf people could tell us some stories. And one woman, and we always have an interpreter at hand, and so one woman got up and said, all right, I'll tell you a story about my dog too, who only obeys sign language. He doesn't listen to anybody. And everyone was just amazed. Her dog, Duke, is dead. No one in that building ever knew that she had a dog named Duke, who only obeyed sign language. And the story suddenly made her, it gives you a feeling of pathos, gives you a feeling of touching her. It made us all laugh hysterically. And the image of her landlady trying to take care of this dog, standing there shouting at this dog to eat, 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 and the dog just stood there and looked at it. And finally, she came to the hospital. The landlady came to the hospital and asked her, what's wrong with your dog? He won't eat. And she said, oh, I'm sorry. You have to spell it out with your hands before him. She went home. She spelled it out. The dog ate. No problem. That makes a real person out of that woman who can't hear, who we can't talk to. We were able to get people telling stories about where they came from, about the homes that they grew up in, about their father's work, about remembering a story that their grandparents told them about the first person who ever built a wood house on the prairie when everybody thought they were crazy. History. Great deal of history among those people, and stories that they never told their own children. Sometimes because there wasn't time. Sometimes because they were taught from little on that you forget about those things. Their parents may have come from the old country, and their parents said, it's new, it's a new country, forget the old country, forget those stories. They never forgot them. They're still there. Now, we can hear them. Now, when they share, they are sharing with people who also have old stories to tell. There's been a great deal of brain research, as I mentioned last night, about which side of the brain does what, and one aspect of brain research that I've heard about recently, which I've even experienced a little bit in some of Jenny Witt's workshops here in the village, is the realization that, well, there is a woman who does workshops in which she gets everyone to lie on the floor, flat on the back, stare at the ceiling, have another person sit next to them, and ask for stories. You say to the person lying on the floor, tell me something you remember from your childhood about a dog, an old man, your sister, your brother, your mother, Christmas, Easter. And you just give little stories, little memories, little things that come into your mind. What happens is that you're triggering, I'm not a great scientist, but you're triggering chemical reactions in your head, neurological synapses, things happening in your head that make those memories come forth. What happens physically is very interesting because as you sit up slowly, easily from this experience, you suddenly realize that the colors are brighter, that the room is clearer, that you can smell things you couldn't smell before. And they are finding that in brain research, that sort of pulling out of long-term memory increases short-term memory. And some of the difficulties of senility may have to do with the fact that nobody ever talks to these people. And we all know the typical image of senility being the person who can remember that Calvin Coolidge's middle name was, but doesn't know who's president right now. Somehow, in our minds, all of those things are hooked together. When we sit and tell stories with each other, we are doing more than sharing with each other. We are helping ourselves function, move ahead, take a step into life. Creating images is part of what we all do. And working with these three particular groups, I am hoping to find ways in which we can bring those images together and help all the groups see not only their own images, but other people's images. And when we start imaging, we start understanding not the specifics, the details, but the people, that we can touch them, that they have emotions, that they love, that they hate, that they feel much the same as we do. When you look at the art of the Hmong, the Native Americans, and the Scandinavians, just their visual art, their graphic art, the lines are very much the same. They do the same kinds of things when they image. In churches, over the last 15 years, I've worked with creative dramatics with churches all over the country. These two collections of plays, which are available in the bookstore, one is 28 plays created by a church of 65 members over 18 months in Hyde Park, in Chicago. 65 people, over 95% of them involved with this project in some way or other, creating images that have to do with texts, with celebrations, with Christmas, with Easter, with Lent, finding ways to express themselves. Some of them last 30 seconds, some last 30 minutes. They're all simply images that a group of people worked on to express themselves. This book, For All Seasons, comes from groups spread out farther around the country, from Holden Village, from Syracuse, New York, from Meridian, Mississippi, from Chicago. Again, different types of presentations that people got together and said, what does this mean for us? How do we respond to this text, to this celebration? People who, as I said before, when we sat down in a group at the beginning of a session, were convinced they couldn't create anything. that their images had no specific point to me, and that maybe just their random thoughts would be embarrassing. And after a while, they were able to come up with a drama, a story, something to express, however short it was, what they felt, what they believed, how they responded. The last thing that I like to do in these sessions is a little bit of practical application. I will take questions. If you want to talk more about this, I'll be glad to. But I just want to do a little exercise that I do with each group that I work with, just to help us begin to see how images emerge within a group. It's a very simple exercise. It's called a word at a time story. You may have done it. You may have done it as children. You may have done it with the children. It's simply a matter of taking a blank place in which there is nothing, and taking us as a group of people who have words that we can put on here, and attempt one word at a time, in order, attempt to create a story. The only rules are that you get one word. When it's your turn, it's your turn, it's your word. Your word needs somehow to relate to what has gone before. But the goal of your word is simply to continue the story, to keep it going until we find out where it ends. Very simple. Let's try it. I always like to start the stories with we, because it's a group of us who are doing it. Okay, if the first word in our story is we, what might the second word be?
Ran.
We
ran.
Ran. Ran away to.
The.
Ran away to the.
Painful.
To the painful. Fine. We ran away to the painful.
Realization.
Back here.
Oops, sorry.
That's all right. Oh, that's all right. She can choose it if she wants it.
My eyes, I can never.
I'm sorry. Back there, realization, which we ran away, painful realization, which we ran away to painful realization, which led
to,
which led to. We ran away to the painful realization, which led to celebration. Now, if we go around maybe once or twice more and try to expand on what that is, we might have, we've already got an interesting beginning. We ran away to the painful realization, which led to celebration, semicolon. Continue the story. How? How we
together.
How we together
could
we ran away to a painful realization which led to celebration. How we together could commune. Oh. How we together could commune and. Here. Commune and.
Rise.
Rise. Okay, real quickly. Commune and rise to
survival.
I'm sorry, to
such.
To such. How we could together commune and rise to such
happiness.
Three more words. I mean, I don't know if it's going to work that way, but.
Rise to happiness.
immune and rise to such happiness.
An adjective, beautifully or wonderfully, something.
Okay, happened. How we could rise together to, how we could commune, how we together could commune and rise to such happiness.
Expanding.
Hmm. All right.
Our
lives.
Mine. Lives, did you say?
Lives.
Lives. Okay. The basic thing that I want to show is that when together we are making something like this, the important thing that, the thing that becomes important for us is we care how it ends. We all have a stake in how it ends. And it's not a story that any one of us would make. And it's a story from which we could then move on to make a more coherent, longer, like a short story or a drama or a poem. But it gives images that we now share. And working with those images, we could do all kinds of things. And in another hour, we could make a drama out of them. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.